I'd like to warmly welcome everyone to this Wednesday gathering, a live teleconference prayer and gratitude meeting hosted by prayerfulliving.com and open to everyone. We are delighted that you've joined us as a participant in this spiritual oasis. For those of you with a computer, our web address for this meeting is prayerfulgathering.com. To hear previous healing messages, click on the link labeled Wednesday Gathering Audio Archive on the prayerfulgathering.com webpage. Hymn number 263.
So we find the true atonement known in God.
For those of you just joining, welcome to this healing meeting at prayerfulgathering.com. Woven throughout the structure of these readings to create a single tapestry are the books The Voice, The Message, and King James versions of the Bible, with correlative passages from miscellaneous writings and Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures by Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science. For an uninterrupted flow, the books of the Bibles are from Exodus, Leviticus, Isaiah, Galatians, Proverbs, John, 1 Timothy, and 2 Corinthians, and will not otherwise be announced. The topic of today's healing message is a close encounter or atonement at one-ment. God began to speak directly to all the people. Until now, God has only dealt with Moses on behalf of his people at Mount Sinai. He turns to address them directly in order to express the core of his covenant obligations. He begins by reminding them of all he has done for them. I am the Eternal, your God. I led you out of Egypt and liberated you from lives of slavery and oppression. When the people realized Moses was taking too long a time to return from his trek up the mountain, they got together and approached Aaron. This is truly a dark moment for Israel. Moses left Aaron and Hur in charge 40 days ago, and both men are beginning to feel the strain. The people are stuck in the desert, and they are growing increasingly impatient without Moses and direction from God. So the people begin to question, and eventually they demand a physical representation of God, like the ones their neighbors have. Aaron complies. With Moses and God occupied, the people begin breaking the 10 directives, one after another, worshiping other gods, making idols, invoking God's name for their own selfish purposes, and committing other indecent acts. The people of God fall quickly, and they fall hard. For a brief period, their very survival is in doubt. Then the Eternal One speaks, "Go back down the mountain immediately because your people, whom you led out of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have quickly abandoned the way of life I require of them." After Aaron's two sons died before the Lord said to Moses, "Warn your brother Aaron not to enter into the holy place behind the veil where the ark and the place of mercy are, just whenever he chooses. The priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord, and he shall be forgiven." Then Moses stated again that all he had done that day had been commanded by the Lord in order to make atonement for them. "You felt secure in all your wickedness. 'No one sees me,' you said. 'Your wisdom and knowledge have caused you to turn away from me and claim that you yourself are Jehovah. That is why disaster shall overtake you suddenly, so suddenly that you won't know where it comes from. And there will be no atonement then to cleanse away your sins. What is the point then of the law, the attached addendum? It was a thoughtful addition to the original covenant promises made to Abraham. The purpose of the law was to keep a sinful people in the way of salvation until Christ came, inheriting the promises and distributing them to us. Obviously, this law was not a first-hand encounter with God. It was arranged by angelic messengers through a middleman, Moses. But if there is a middleman, as there was at Sinai, then the people are not dealing directly with God, are they? But the original promise is the direct blessing of God, received by faith. Hear me, my people. You swear allegiance to the Lord without meaning a word of it when you boast of living in the holy city and brag about depending on the God of Israel. Time and again, I told you what was going to happen in the future. My words were scarcely spoken when suddenly I did just what I said. I knew how hard and obstinate you are. Your necks are as unbending as iron. You are as hard-headed as brass. That is why I told you ahead of time what I was going to do, so that you could never say, 'My idol did it. My carved image commanded it to happen.' You have heard my predictions and seen them fulfilled, but you refuse to agree it is so. Now I will tell you new things I haven't mentioned before, secrets you haven't heard. Listen to me, my people, my chosen ones. I alone am God. I am the first. I am the last. It was my hand that laid the foundations of the earth. The palm of my right hand spread out the heavens above. I spoke, and they came into being. Come closer and listen. I have always told you plainly what would happen, so that you could clearly understand. With this wisdom, you are able to choose the right road. Seek justice and decide what is good and fair. Because wisdom will penetrate deep within, and knowledge will become a good friend to your soul. Sound judgment will stand guard over you, and understanding will watch over you as promised. And this condition of rightness, holiness, and cleanliness is a product of how they are in relation not only to God, but also to each other and to the very land itself. These things are inseparable. The consequences of their failure to ensure the holiness of this sacred place by being right with God, land, and others are dire indeed. God must cleanse his people and place because he determines to be represented within and by them. And of those strangers who are not among the chosen people, Israel, yet have bound themselves to the eternal, attend to God, and love all that the eternal is and does, if they serve him, keep the Sabbath, make good choices, and cling to the terms of the covenant, I will bring them into my holy mountain where no foreigner is allowed, and give them a joyful welcome within my house of prayer, because my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations." These words must have come as a surprise to the Hebrews. They were called the ones, the chosen, and had been commanded to keep themselves separate from their pagan neighbors. Now they hear these words of inclusion. They are told it doesn't matter who they are or where they've come from or what imperfections they might have. Any who have bound themselves to Israel's God, even if they're not Israel, even if they're not whole, belong to him and will enjoy all the wonders that he has in store for them. One day it will be clear that they are a sign of God's goodness and mercy, that God's justice is on display through their lives. They are to live as the light of God to the neighboring countries. And the one who brings all Israel together, the Lord, the Eternal, declares, "I am not yet done. I will still gather more to this community." In a small Samaritan town known as Sychar, Jesus and his entourage stopped to rest at the historic well that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. It was about noon when Jesus found a spot to sit close to the well, while the disciples ventured off to find provisions. From his vantage, he watched as a Samaritan woman approached to draw some water. Unexpectedly, he spoke to her. "Would you draw water and give me a drink?" the woman said. "I cannot believe that you, a Jew, would associate with me, a Samaritan woman, much less ask me to give you a drink. Jews, you see, have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus, "You don't know the gift of God or who is asking you for a drink of this water from Jacob's well, because if you did, you would have asked him for something greater and he would have given you the living water." The woman, "Sir, you sit by this deep well, a thirsty man without a bucket in sight. Where does this living water come from? Are you claiming superiority to our father Jacob, who labored long and hard to dig and maintain this well so that he could share clean water with his sons, grandchildren, and cattle?" Jesus, "Drink this water, and your thirst is quenched only for a moment. You must return to this well again and again. I offer water that will become a wellspring within you that gives life throughout eternity. You will never be thirsty again." The woman, "Please, sir, give me some of this water so that I'll never be thirsty and never again have to make the trip to this well." Jesus, "Then bring your husband to me." The woman, "I do not have a husband." Jesus, "Technically, you're telling the truth, but you have had five husbands and are currently living with a man you are not married to." The woman, "Sir, it is obvious to me that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped here on this mountain, but your people say that Jerusalem is the only place for all to worship. Which is it?" Jesus, "Woman, I tell you that neither is so. Believe this. A new day is coming. In fact, it's already here, when the importance will not be placed on the time and place of worship, but on the truthful hearts of worshipers. Guard the treasure you were given. Guard it with your life. Avoid the talk show religion and the practiced confusion of the so-called experts and oppositions of science, falsely so-called. People caught up in a lot of talk can miss the whole point of faith. The prayer that reforms the sinner and heals the sick is an absolute faith that all things are possible to God, a spiritual understanding of him, an unself-love. The design of love is to reform the sinner. Was John's faith greater than that of the Samaritan woman who said, 'Is not this the Christ, the divine manifestation of God which comes to the flesh to destroy incarnate error?' And they that are Christ's have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. Wisdom and love may require many sacrifices of self to save us from sin. One sacrifice, however great, is insufficient to pay the debt of sin. The atonement requires constant self-immolation on the sinner's part. that God's wrath should be vented upon his beloved Son is divinely unnatural. Such a theory is man-made. The atonement is a hard problem in theology, but its scientific explanation is that suffering is an error of sinful sense, which truth destroys, and that eventually both sin and suffering will fall at the feet of everlasting love. To suppose that persecution for righteousness' sake belongs to the past and that Christianity today is at peace with the world because it is honored by sects and societies is to mistake the very nature of religion. Error repeats itself. The trials encountered by prophet, disciple, and apostle, of whom the world was not worthy, await in some form every pioneer of truth. The determination to hold spirit in the grasp of matter is the persecutor of truth and love. There is too much animal courage in society and not sufficient moral courage. Christians must take up arms against error at home and abroad. They must grapple with sin in themselves and in others and continue this warfare until they have finished their course. If we have triumphed sufficiently over the errors of material sense to allow soul to hold the control, we shall loathe sin and rebuke it under every mask. Only in this way can we bless our enemies, though they may not so construe our words. We cannot choose for ourselves, but must work out our salvation in the way Jesus taught. In meekness and might, he was found preaching the gospel to the poor, the receptive thought. Pride and fear are unfit to bear the standard of truth, and God will never place it in such hands. Again, foreseeing the persecution which would attend the science of spirit, Jesus said, "They shall put you out of the synagogues. Yea, the time cometh that whosoever killeth you will think that he doth God service. And these things will they do unto you because they have not known the Father nor me." Frankly, I am stunned. I cannot believe that you have abandoned God so quickly, even after he called you through the grace of the Anointed One, and have fallen from a different gospel. Actually, there is only one true gospel of the Anointed, and you, because of divisive prodding by others, are accepting a distorted version, which is not the gospel at all. If the soft palm upturned to a lordly salary and architectural skill, making dome and spire tremulous with beauty, turn the poor, the receptive thought, and the stranger from the gate, they at the same time shut the door on progress. Science is the stranger that is within thy gate, remembered not even when its elevating effects practically prove its divine origin and efficacy. It shows the scientific relation of man to God, disentangles the interlaced ambiguities of being, and sets free the imprisoned thought. In divine science, the universe, including man, is spiritual, harmonious, and eternal. Science shows that what is termed matter is but the subjective state of what is termed by the author mortal mind. It is their materiality that clogs the progress of students. And this kind goeth not forth but by prayer and fasting. It is materialism through which the animal magnetizer preys, P-R-E-Y-S, and in turn becomes a prey. Spirituality is the basis of all true thought and volition. When the human element in him struggled with the divine, our great teacher said, "Not my will, but thine be done." That is, let not the flesh, but the spirit be represented in me. This is the new understanding of spiritual love. It gives all for Christ or truth. It blesses its enemies, heals the sick, casts out error, raises the dead from trespasses and sins, and preaches the gospel to the poor, the meek in heart. Christians, are you drinking his cup? Have you shared the blood of the new covenant, the persecutions which attend a new and higher understanding of God? If not, can you then say that you have commemorated Jesus in his cup? Are all who eat bread and drink wine in memory of Jesus willing to drink his cup, take his cross, and leave all for the Christ principle? If Christ, truth, has come to us in demonstration, no other commemoration is requisite, for demonstration is Emmanuel, or God with us. If all who ever partook of the sacrament had really commemorated the sufferings of Jesus and drunk of his cup, they would have revolutionized the world. Every mortal at some period here or hereafter must grapple with and overcome the mortal belief in a power opposed to God. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. The scripture, "Thou hast been faithful over a few things, I will make thee ruler over many," is literally fulfilled when we are conscious of the supremacy of truth, by which the nothingness of error is seen. And we know that the nothingness of error is in proportion to its wickedness. He that touches the hem of Christ's robe and masters his mortal belief, animality, and hate, rejoices in the proof of healing, in a sweet and certain sense that God is love. For there's nothing we can do to oppose the truth. All we can do is align ourselves with it. This is having our part in the at-one-ment with truth and love. Glory be to God, and peace to the struggling hearts. Christ hath rolled away the stone from the door of human hope and faith, and through the revelation and demonstration of life in God, hath elevated them to possible at-one-ment with the spiritual idea of man and his divine principle, love.
Thine is the key.